This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. Time for Place to Be Nation's Year in Pop. Each episode, we go back in time to a year in the past and take a trip down memory lane and see what was going on in the worlds of news, sports, and pop culture with your hosts, Andy Atherton and Scott Criscolo.
Place to Be Nation, welcome back to the Year in Pop. That's right, we're traveling back in time once again on the Place to Be Nation Pop feed. But you know what? I am Andy Atherton, and I don't do it alone. I am going to be joined by a few great guys. You've heard them all before on the show, but let me start off with my co-host. He is the co-host of the Place to Be podcast and co-host of the Main Event over on the Wrestling Feed, makes numerous appearances here on the Pop feed regularly, Mr. Scott Criscolo. Scott, how are you tonight, my friend?
Well, it sounds like since you've moved, you've smoked quite a few cigarettes.
Yeah, it's one of those days.
You sound like one of the Simpsons sisters. No, Andy, it's always good. Always a pleasure to be with you. Welcome, Place to Be Nation Pop Feed, to the Year in Pop. Yes, indeed. And we are turning back the clock to probably, I would say this, even though a lot of big things happened in this year, you can almost argue that it was maybe the last, like, kind of anonymous, bland year of the decade. We are, of course, talking about 1975, because you figure the second half of the decade, 76 through 79, I mean, disco, huge movies, presidential elections, death, you know, pop culture deaths and, you know, disco. So,
yeah.
So like from 76 pretty much till the end of the decade, those years are just loaded with historic events of all levels. So this might be the last kind of nondescript year, but we got some good gems, music, a couple of epic TV shows debuted, obviously one of the most competitive and greatest World Series of all time occurred in 75.
Yeah,
we'll get to that.
You know, I feel like when I was prepping for the show, this looks like it was the end and then a beginning of a lot of things. You know, have you know, a difference, kind of a shift in television, a shift in the culture. You know, out are the old 60s stuff, and it's really, you're really in the heart of the 70s. Obviously, it's the middle of the decade, but, you know, disco is coming on. Fashion is changing. Lifestyles are changing. Movies, the way we watch movies, or not watch, but way movies are released, the big change starts this year. So, yeah, lots of stuff. A long-running show starts that's still on the air. One of the most... you know, biggest shows in history that gave the start to many, many, many great actors, comedians, actresses, etc. Yep. So, you know, it's not just me and Scott, though, here tonight. You know, we're joined by the rest of our, we'll call it our Year in Pop 70s crew. First, let's bring in, he has been heard around these parts for many years. His appearances are on Year in Pop right now. We'll see if we can get him on some more shows. But for now, he's all ours. That's right. It's the doctor, Dr. G, George Rebellino. George, how are you tonight, my friend?
How you doing, guys? I'm looking forward to talking about 1975. I Scott's right. Not the most exciting year in the world, but you know what? You know, once we get into it, we'll make it exciting.
Yeah, we make everything exciting.
I know a guy who's Mr. Exciting, and he is the other member of our crew tonight. He is, of course, co-host of This Week in Sports with the Cowboy, and of course, he is a veteran of all podcasts. He's with me often on the Place to Be podcast with myself and JR. We just did an epic a few weeks ago, an epic WrestleMania 5 podcast, and he was in the Big Toilet of Hartford, says Elias. And that is Mr. J. Arsenio D'Amato. How are you, Johnny?
Yes, borrowing Doc Brown and Marty McFly's time machine, we went back to 89 for our for a place to for WrestleMania 5. Now we're going back to 1975. One of the big hits was Love Will Keep Us Together. And my love for you guys in 1970s will keep us together.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Ooh, I love you in any decade.
There are a lot of one-hit wonders in 75, but I'm with three guys who aren't one-hit wonders. You guys got many hits coming.
Oh, thank you.
Let's keep them rolling.
Let's keep them rolling, yes.
It's a love fest over here.
It is. It is. Plenty of love. There was some...
What was in the water up in Hartford?
Oh, God. Well, of course, Elias didn't drink it, that's for sure. gentlemen, yeah, big time year in 1975. And a lot of it was a transition year in some ways, both in obviously TV. And we're going to talk about TV because TV started, I noticed, we'll get to that in a little bit, but TV was starting to make a change. But the biggest change, I think, and Andy, you alluded to, we'll do this on the back end of the show in the B block, is movies. Mm-hmm. One director, and we'll get into him later, kind of changed the landscape of how to promote and market the big movie. Who knows how The Godfather would have been if it was released later in the decade when marketing things was a bigger deal. You know what I mean? But why don't we get to hopping in, Mr. Atherton, and tell us what life was like for the everyday schmo like us in 1975.
Well, yes, us everyday schmoes back in 75. Well, you know, like we always like to start off here on Europop, we like to talk about, you know, some of the stats, some of the, you know, economics of the time. And the average cost of a new house was $39,300. That's up $5,000 from 74. That's a pretty significant jump. There, I would say that's like blah, 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 math in my head, like 8% at least, probably an eighth or whatever. So the average income per year went up $200. It was went up to $14,100, and then the average monthly rent was $200, and then the cost of a new car was $4,250. But some other things that kind of held steady was a gallon of gas was only 44 cents. That only went up 2 cents. And the inflation rate actually dropped from 11.3% to 9.2%.
I think a lot of that had to do with Gerald Ford being in office, I think. I think for maybe a brief window, I think the country was a little more – confident economically. A big event in the world in news took place in 75 that may have changed things a little bit. We'll get to that in the B block, but that's the only thing I can think of. I mean, believe me, it doesn't say 9.2% very long throughout the rest of the decade, 70s. It gets a lot uglier. 44 cents for gas. My God.
Ugh, God,
that's crazy.
Yeah.
You know, what do you think, G? You think your dad's Lincoln was 42.50?
A little bit more than that, I think. But still, I mean, the 44 cents a gallon, I mean, you think about even when I remember when I was a kid, even, we used to look to see to get it under a dollar. You know, you get it for like 98 cents or 99 cents a gallon. Now, what are we paying? $3 now, just about?
Something like
pretty
that.
Much.
Well, it's
pretty
not,
much depends where.
Yeah. Well, I remember how many years ago it was. It was like, what, like 8 to 10 years ago? It was up of like almost $5.
Yes.
You know, that's riding a long commute in a big car. That was not fun. $80 twice a week to fill out my car.
That's great.
I was driving an Envoy at the time. That was a big mistake. But, you know, not a lot happened in terms of pop culture significance, at least. But Sony introduced the Betamax VHS tape, and Matsushita / JVC introduced VHS. So that was the one of the original format wars that has happened. Mm-hmm. You know, we've had many 3Ds. We had Blu-ray versus, you know, HD DVD. We had, you know, all the consoles, and this was really one of the first ones that VHS ended up winning. But Betamax was actually fairly popular. You know, I only had like a couple of my friends had Betamaxes when we were kids, and
I did.
Yeah,
my dad was very and G knows my dad. My dad was very particular and researched, and he read things, and he read that Betamax, and they were not wrong, Betamax was the better quality tape than VHS was. But for some reason, VHS was marketed better and VHS was produced faster. So there were more VHS VCRs made than Betamax, and eventually Betamax.
And it was cheap.
And it was cheap. Yeah. So, you know, my dad, old school Italian, pinching the pennies. We had a beta. I didn't get a VHS in my house until the mid 80s, believe it or not.
Wow.
Yeah, but, we had a Betamax back in the 70s, as I remember because I was still living in Brooklyn at the time. My first movie was The Wizard of Oz.
Wow.
I watched that thing over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Also, Motorola obtained the patent for the first portable mobile phone.
Jeez. Isn't that nuts? In 1975.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
When did
Pauly dangerously get his? 1985, so like in 10 years.
yeah, the Zach Morris model. And then also the name Microsoft for microcomputer software, and Microsoft becomes a registered trademark that year. That year, Bill Gates and, let me call it up here, Bill Gates I totally lost my tab here. Sorry about that, everybody. But Bill Gates and Paul Allen developed a basic program for their Altair 8800 computer. So you know, one, like many self-made millionaire billionaire companies started in a garage somewhere.
Yep.
But that's amazing, you know, that all starts, you know, with one little program.
And so then, that's the problem. I don't have a garage. That's why I'm not a millionaire.
Jets don't count.
It's not
the back of minivans.
No. As long as it's not a she shed.
Yeah.
So in terms of toys that was out, there was the Matchbox Steer and Go Car set. Those little children's phonograph players became popular then too. Remember those? You get those plastic records.
Yep.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah.
Portable cassette players became popular as the ones, you know, you would hold up to the radio because you couldn't really afford to go and buy a record sometimes.
Yeah.
And then the Evel Knievel dragster with the chute. You know, I love those toys.
With its own six pack.
Yeah.
Bottle doing all.
If you try to jump the fountain in your backyard, then you know, kind of breaks his neck. But
just like in real life.
Yeah. So I love those toys that would come with a chute because you could deploy it once and then you never got it back.
Pretty much.
Yeah. And then we had Mr. Potato Head was popular then. Bert and Ernie dolls, train sets, like the tennis. This tennis game came out almost like a portable Pong, where you would have a little handheld thing where you had boom on your little on each side. You know, Monopoly, Scrabble, original versions, Barbie dolls for the girls, ventriloquist dummy. Yeah, no, thank you. I'm good.
You actually buy them? I imagine those are cheap.
Well, back then they were probably different though.
Yeah.
They weren't like, you know, you're not buying, you know, Madam or Peanut or whoever.
Right. Or the evil marionette from Magic, that great horror movie with Anthony Hopkins.
Ah.
Which I don't know, for a couple of years.
I remember the 70s were a big time, though, for dummies. Do you remember that? You had Willie Tyler and Lester.
Yep.
Yeah, Waylon Flowers and Madam.
Yep.
Right, yeah, that other guy, Jay, who was on Soap, was out of the 80s.
Chuck and Bob, yeah.
Chuck and Bob.
Drunk and Bob, yeah.
Yeah, and then, there were a few other ones, I think, that came out then.
Mm-hmm.
Still kind of freaky a little bit.
I forgot about Lester. Oh, my God, I totally forgot about him.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, he was on TV all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. My God.
He was always on, like Match Game and stuff.
Yes, yep. Match Game.
Yeah.
Game show.
Anyway.
So, all right.
Had some notable deaths. So, Francisco Franco, the dictator of Spain, died.
Now, Generalissimo.
Yes, that's right. I remember that's from Saturday Night Live. You know, they have Garrett Morris. Tonight's top stories are going to be translated by Garrett Morris for those who are hearing impaired.
Yes.
Our top stories tonight.
Sorry, tonight.
Generalissimo Franco is still dead. And then the great Rod Serling passed away, the host and creator of Twilight Zone. Now, this next one's debatable if he's really dead. I mean, he should be by now anyway. If it wasn't, it was Jimmy Hoffa.
I think we did the WrestleMania tailgate over him.
Did we? That's true. That's quite possible. I remember going to the old Giant Stadium with a buddy of mine. As soon as we sit down, he goes, "Which corner is Hoffa buried in?"
It was the S in the south end zone.
Yes. And let's see, Chiang Kai-shek passed away, the president of the Republic of China. Josephine Baker, the great dancer. Aristotle Onassis.
Yes. You know, the Greek magnate that that Jackie O married after JFK died.
Yeah. Yes. Two of the Three Stooges, Mo Howard and Larry Fine, both died that year.
Really? Mm-hmm. I didn't know they both died.
Yeah, time. Damn.
Yeah.
Same year, yeah.
Wow, that's crazy.
Back to back.
Wow.
Back to back.
Yeah, I think Curly was dead already, though, by this point.
Yeah,
He was
Curly died in the 60s. I think Shemp was the last one standing.
Ah, or is Joe. Curly Joe, whatever they call it.
Yeah.
Susan Hayward, the fine actress from the Golden Age of the Silver Screen. Mm-hmm. Steve Prefontaine.
The epic track runner.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Pete Ham, I don't know why I wrote him on the list, but I'd have to look it up again. You can tell I prepped kind of late. Ozzie Nelson of Ozzie and Harriet fame.
You're the master at breaking the fourth wall.
I am.
let me look up. Keep reading the names, and we'll look up Pete Ham.
All right. Let's see who we got here. The great Casey Stengel.
1975. I didn't realize.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I know Pete Ham. Johnny, Pete Ham was in Badfinger.
Ah, that's what it was.
He was the lead singer. He killed himself. That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, the lead singer who sang Without You and No Matter What You Are, I Will Always Be With That. Those guys. That's right. He killed himself.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. I do remember that. All right, so that's actually a good one. That's a good one.
All right. And then did you hear me say Casey Stengel?
Yes, I did. Casey Stengel did pass away.
Okay. And then Sam Giancana, the mob guy.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And then we had Moms Mabley, the great African-American comedian.
I don't know.
Yeah, she was big back in the time when people of that color were not that big in terms of comedy.
I see.
And then on the other side of the fence, though, we got some notable births in 75. I mean, these people are, you know, who's who of Hollywood nowadays. You know, Bradley Cooper, Charlize Theron, Angelina Jolie, Drew Barrymore.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, Drew Barrymore. You wouldn't think Drew Barrymore and Angelina Jolie are the same age.
I know, right? Isn't that crazy?
And then Kate Winslet, Russell Brand, Mila Jovovich, David Harbour of, Stranger Things fame, Tobey Maguire, Sarah Gilbert, Eva Longoria, Jason Sudeikis, Johnny Galecki, Casey Affleck, Judy Greer, Marion Cotillard, Tara Reid, Winnie Cooper herself, Danica McKellar, Caitlin Olson, and Zach Braff, as well as Sean Lennon, Jamie Oliver. And then music, this was a big year for music births, especially in the hip-hop R&B circles. We have Mark Ronson. It was, Bruno Mars' frequent collaborator, Fitty Cent.
Fitty?
Well, somebody's on the other side of the spectrum, Michael Bublé.
They didn't do a duet, did they?
No. Travis Barker of Blink-182. Former Spice Girl Mel B.
Mm-hmm.
DJ Khaled. Miss Lauryn Hill.
Mm-hmm.
Enrique Iglesias. Jack White of the White Stripes. Brian Littrell of the Backstreet Boys, and Nelly Imbruglia. And we go over to sports. We got, of course, probably arguably the greatest golfer of all time. Arguably. Tiger Woods.
I wouldn't go that far yet.
Then we got A-Rod. Let me ask you, while we're talking about A-Rod, it's something I wanted to bring up on Great Debate. I haven't had a chance to. I mean, what do you guys feel of him as an announcer / analyst?
I think he's exceptional.
I was blown away. He's really damn good.
No, he's been awesome the minute he hit a mic.
He's a baseball rat. Like he does know his stuff. I mean,
whatever.
He makes what's her face, Jessica. Well, the way the Mets are running now, she should go back to being an announcer. She sucks at that too. But he used to just completely embarrass her because she's a moron, and A-Rod used to just school her literally all the time. But no, he's fantastic.
Yeah,
I think it's better than Schilling.
And also born that year they're hysterical together too when they go at each other. Big Poppy, David Ortiz. Mm-hmm. They had that bet. Was it last year they did the bet? The loser had to wear the other team's uniform. So I think A-Rod had to wear a Red Sox uniform.
Yeah, jacket, I think.
Oh, it was a jacket.
Yeah, it was a jacket, yeah.
And then we had David Beckham was born also, 75. Mm-hmm. Allen Iverson, the great, was he Georgetown, right, Scott?
Yes.
Georgetown, then on to the Sixers. Ray Lewis, of the, uh-huh. another guy who turned into a pretty good analyst. Mm-hmm. And Tito Ortiz. And now, yeah. And we got wrestling. We have probably two of the greatest women of all time. We got Trish Stratus and Lita, both born 75. And we have Das Wunderkind, Alex Wright.
Alex,
Berlin.
That's right. Then we had D'Lo Brown, who I feel is vastly underrated during his run. Then we have the coach, Jonathan yes. Coachman. Mm-hmm. And then we had a great wrestler with a crap gimmick, Mr. Nick Dinsmore, better known as Eugene. Mm-hmm. Then we had Rhino. Depending how, with an I, with a Y, however you want
to
do it.
Depending what promotion you're referring to, yeah.
And we had Shelton Benjamin, mm-hmm. the late Andrew Martin, a.k.a. Test, mm-hmm. and the recent Hall of Fame inductee, Tori Wilson.
Oh.
All born 75. So so with that, though, we're going to move on to the world of sports, and I hand over to my co-host, Mr. Chris Golo. So, Scott, take us to the world of sports.
Yes, well, we talked about some of those whose birthdays and or births and deaths in the world of sports. But 1975 had some big moments. Actually, we saw the retirement of great, maybe arguably the greatest college basketball coach of all time, retired. And but we'll do baseball first. The Hall of Fame class that year, not a star-studded one, but certainly one that earned its keep. Earl Averill, Billy Herman. And arguably one of Johnny's and my favorite announcers of all time, Mr. Ralph Kiner, who, of course, he was the last guy to hit 50 home runs before somebody would do it 2 years later from here, 1977. Then the Veterans Committee, Bucky Harris, who – didn't he play for the Yankees? Maybe he managed the Yankees?
I don't know.
Did Bucky Harris manage the Yankees, Jay? I thought he did.
I don't know.
Let me see. I could have sworn Bucky Harris managed the Yankees at some point. Let me see. Bucky Harris.
That's what happens when we have a long layoff between shows.
Bucky Harris played in the Japanese Baseball League from – oh, this is a different guy. Oh, better known – oh, this is a different Bucky Harris. Sorry. Here he is. American Major League player, manager, executive, Baseball Hall of Fame.
He managed the Yankees for two seasons.
Yeah, he played for the Senators from 1919 to 1928. And the Tigers in 1929. He played for the Tigers in 29 and 31. He managed the Senators, the Tigers, the Red Sox, the Senators, the Phillies. God, this guy's like Tom Trebelhorn. The Phillies, the Yankees, the Senators again. He managed the Senators three different times. And then finally he managed the Tigers. He managed the Senators three times, 24 to 28, 35 to 42, and 50 to 54.
Well, how many times did Billy Martin manage the Yankees?
that is quite true. His final record, I didn't say what his record is as a manager. He did win two rings, though, yep. with the 24 Senators and, of course, with the 47 Yankees. So I knew he had won. I knew he managed Yankees somewhere. Mm-hmm. So there was your Hall of Fame class. Of course, as I mentioned, the division winners, the Red Sox, the Yankees were still getting under their feet in 1975. The A's had won yet another division title. Were they going to four-peat? We hadn't seen that since the Yankees did it. The Pirates won the NL East. The Mets still sucked. And the Cincinnati Reds won the NL West. Although, actually, 75, I don't know if the Mets were that bad in 75. I don't think they really hit the toilet until after the Midnight Massacre, which Johnny and I will allude to in 77. Your AL MVP, Freddie Lynn, Boston Red Sox, who started a great career. Joe Morgan won the NL MVP. Dr. G's favorite, got one of his favorite guys, Joe Morgan, says the Yankee dynasty sucked. Jim Palmer won the AL Cy Young. Steve Carlton won the NL Cy Young. And Freddie Lynn also won the Rookie of the Year. So he won Rookie of the Year and MVP in the same season. And the NL Rookie of the Year was one of my favorite players as a kid, the Hawk, Andre Dawson, for the Montreal Expos. Love the Hawk. Your World Series that year, arguably one of the most competitive and one of the best World Series of all time. The Cincinnati Reds and the Boston Red Sox went seven games. So the Red Sox knocked Oakland out in 75, and that was the end of an era for the Oakland A's, because a lot of guys either retired or got traded. Of course, that was it for Reggie. He would play, of course, for Baltimore in 76, and then we all know where he went after that, and we'll get to that again. The Reds, of course, had a who's who of Hall of Fame studs. Johnny Bench, Dave Concepcion, George Foster, Ken Griffey, Joe Morgan, as I mentioned, Tony Perez, Raleigh Eastwick, of course, Charlie Hustle, Pete Rose. Not a bad little Red Sox team, though. Cecil Cooper, which I always forget he played for the Red Sox. I mean, when we were kids, he was mostly a Brewer. Mm-hmm. He was on Harvey's Wallbangers a few years later. Denny Doyle, Dewey. I think Dewey was a rookie, actually, too. Dwight Evans. Of course, Carlton Fisk, Freddie Lynn, Louis Tiant, and, of course, Yaz. Pete Rose won the MVP, and, of course, two huge home runs in that series, both of them in Game 6. Of course, everyone knows the Carlton Fisk, you know, push the ball fair home yeah. run as he danced down the first base line to win Game 6. But he wouldn't have gotten to that point if a little-known infielder, he looks like he worked on the docks or worked in a deli, Bernie Carbo, wow. hit a pinched three-run homer. I think it was in the eighth inning to tie the game at 6. Reds were up 6-3 and were about to close the series out in 6 games. Well, Bernie Carbo tied it. Carlton Fisk won it, I think, in the 11th. But then, of course, the Red Sox won it, I think, on a Joe Morgan home run in Game 7. And they won their first of back-to-back World Championships. And the Red Sox would not make the World Series again for 11 years. And we all know who they played there.
What a shame.
In the NCAA Division I Men's Basketball Tournament, your Final Four, by the way, Richard Washington was the tournament's most outstanding player from UCLA. It was in San Diego. Your Final Four was UCLA, Kentucky, Louisville, and Syracuse. Of course, this is the days of pre-Big East. Big East wouldn't be built for a few years. UCLA beat Kentucky 92-85, and it was the final game for arguably. I'm curious your thoughts on this, Johnny, being a college hoop guy like me. I think it's hard to argue that this guy will probably always be the greatest college basketball coach of all time. And that, of course, is the great John Wooden, who retired after this game, passed away about 3 or 4 years ago. I think he was 99, lived a great long life. And I mean, obviously, John, the tournament and college hoops in general is a lot different than it was back then. But even so, I can't fathom any other names close to his as the greatest of all time.
Yeah, he was one of the first coaches that really emerged. Usually it was about the players, but when UCLA had that dynasty, it was it was Wooden's team and his philosophies, and also wrote many great books, and his tenets on everything, on life and leadership, are something for everyone to look into that still holds true today.
Oh, I agree. Businesses use them. Oh yeah, there's no doubt. There's no doubt. Incidentally, everyone thinks he played at Purdue. He played at UCLA. He did not. He actually went to Purdue. There you go. So the UCLA Bruins win their last of the Dynasty National Championships, and John Wooden would retire right afterwards. In that year's NBA draft, the number one pick overall was David Thompson, who was drafted by the Atlanta Hawks, but he would not play for the Hawks. He would go to the ABA and go play for the Denver Nuggets. The supplemental number one pick by the Spirit of St. Louis, but then he went to the New Orleans Jazz. The first probably great player that came out directly out of high school and skipped college, and that is, of course,
Moses
Malone, the man who would eventually say, "Fo, fo, fo," for the Sixers 8 years later. But he was drafted by the New Orleans Jazz and also for the Spirits of St. Louis. In the NBA Finals that year, the Golden State Warriors, back when actually winning the NBA title was something foreign to them, swept the Washington Bullets in 4 straight. Rick Barry was the MVP. I mean, that guy shot like Steph Curry when he was hot. Keith Wilkes was on that team. Of course, he would eventually be Jamal Wilkes and would end up playing for the Lakers. Bullets had Wes Unseld and arguably one of the best forwards of all time, Elvin Hayes, and Rick Barry was the MVP. The Kentucky Colonels won the ABA Finals. They beat the Indiana Pacers in five. Artis Gilmore, one of the greatest afros in the history of the NBA, won the Finals MVP. In the National Football League, Super Bowl IX took place in January of 75 at old shithole Tulane Stadium in New Orleans. Of course, guys, in case you – because if anybody watches, like, the Super Bowl IX highlight show, you're like, Jesus, they played a Super Bowl in that dump. I mean, you look at Tulane Stadium, it's a fucking toilet. I mean, it's an utter shithole. But apparently Super Bowl IX was supposed to be the first big game at the brand new spanking New Orleans Superdome, but the Superdome was not done yet. So they had to play at the old rickety Tulane Stadium. Of course, 2 years later in Super Bowl, 3 years later, I should say, in Super Bowl 12, the Cowboys and Denver Broncos would play in the first Super Bowl at the new Superdome. Franco Harris was the MVP. It was the last actually professional game played at Tulane Stadium, and fairly so because it was a toilet. But the Steelers defeated the Minnesota Vikings 16-6 in what would be the beginning of the big dynasty of the 1970s, the first of four Super Bowl championships for the Steel Curtain and the Pittsburgh Steelers, led by Chuck Knoll and the rest of that great team. Bradshaw, Harris, Stallworth, Swan, Mean Joe Green, Elsie Greenwood, Jack Lambert, Mel Blunt, Donnie Shell. I mean, the list goes on and on. Jack Ham. I mean, it just goes on and on. Rocky Blyer, ND guy, almost got his arm shot off in Vietnam, and he comes back, and he's a great running back. Vikings had their share of great guys. Fran Tarkenton, Ron Yeary, the great Purple People Eaters, but they just couldn't – they weren't going to score anything against that Steeler defense. Now, that was the end of the 74 season. The 75 season itself, later that year, your division winners, the Cardinals, Minnesota, the Rams, Dallas won the wild card in the NFC. In the AFC, Baltimore, Pittsburgh, Oakland, and the Bengals won the wild card. Fran Tarkenton won the MVP. Ted Marchibroda of the Colts won the Coach of the Year. Fran Tarkenton also won the Offensive Player of the Year, et cetera, et cetera. Now, speaking of buildings, guys, somebody left Yankee Stadium in 1974. Did not play there anymore. Do we know who it is? Of course we do. It was the New York Football Giants. Finally left Yankee Stadium, Dr. G. You think Steinbrenner kicked him out and said, fuck you, you're not ripping my turf up?
The city of New York owned Yankee Stadium, so I don't think Joe Steinbrenner.
What do you think it was? I mean, I don't know the story. Do you think it was that they just – I'm sure at this point Giant Stadium was starting to get built. So
– yeah, I think that's when all the regular football stadiums started coming around where they wanted to go away from, like, having to share – share stadiums for football, you know, the multipurpose stadiums. So, and at that time, I guess when Giant Stadium was built, that was like the brand new spanking, future of stadiums, everybody. And then you think about it when you've been there, you're like, wow, this was like the, premier stadium at the time back in the 70s.
Yep.
The Giants played at Yale Bowl for a little bit too.
Yes, they did. My dad went to many games there.
Mm-hmm. So did my dad,
brother. Yep. Yep, absolutely. Imagine John at this point, at this stage of life, playing in a multi. Like, I just, it's funny how, like, current sports fans just don't get it. You know what I mean? Like, all those years we used to watch games at, like, Candlestick and the Murph, where, like, you got tackled on the infield. Isn't that crazy? Like, I don't think anybody could handle that now.
Well, the A's and the Raiders.
Raiders, yep, that too. A's and the Raiders. Isn't that crazy, John? That, like, I don't think anybody
also can makes
head around it now,
It also makes more sense because a lot of these stadiums, they're only used for football and a few shows during the summer. But a lot of them stay empty, outside of the eight games a year. There's really not much action in a lot of these stadiums, so it does kind of make sense.
Mm. Exactly, So, yeah, a lot of other things. The league pioneers the use of equipping referees with wireless mics to announce penalties and clearly clarify complex and/or unusual rulings to both fans and the media. For the first time since 1966, and it has not been done since, and that is the Dallas Cowboys did not play on Thanksgiving. Buffalo played the Cardinals. I'm sure that was riveting. Detroit moved into the Silverdome. New Orleans, as mentioned, moved into the Superdome. And as I said, I didn't even finish the thought. The Giants went to Shea, because somebody had to do something there, because I'm sure the baseball games were barren. And for 1975, they shared with the Jets. My God, that turf must have gotten destroyed. Oh, my God. In college football, Oklahoma was your number one team in the country. Alabama won the Sugar Bowl. Arkansas, the Cotton Bowl. UCLA won the Rose Bowl. Good year for the Bruins. Orange Bowl, and Archie Griffin won his second straight Heisman Trophy. No one has done that since. We've had a couple of almost, but it has not happened. And Oklahoma won the national championship, Mr. Barry Switzer.
And in hockey, and then also a couple of great players came out that year in the draft, Scott, as well.
Yes, they did. Did I miss the draft? Anybody of any of note? Let's see. Well, the number one overall pick. The number one overall pick was actually a guy whose jersey I always wanted. Steve Bartkowski was drafted by the Atlanta Falcons. With the number two pick, which actually the Cowboys got in a trade because they were never really that bad until the 80s, they got Randy White, defensive tackle. They tried to play him as a linebacker. That didn't work. But, of course, from this point on, his nickname would be the Manster. With the number four pick in the draft, in my personal opinion – maybe the greatest run of the greatest, if not the greatest running back I ever saw. And that is, of course, Sweetness himself, Walter Payton, the fourth pick in the draft from Jackson State. In fact, two great picks were made from Jackson State. Robert Brazil, who was a linebacker for the Oilers, was picked sixth. Russ Francis was drafted 16th by the Patriots. And, of course, he would eventually go on to win rings with the 49ers. Fred Dean was drafted by the Chiefs with the 33rd pick. He would, of course, win a ring eventually with the 49ers. And Fred Solomon was drafted by the Dolphins with the 36th pick. He also would eventually win rings with the 49ers. So the Patriots, Chiefs, and Dolphins all did stupid things.
Another college friend of my aunt's who went to the University of Tampa. She knew Solomon. She knew Matuzak. She knew Paul Orndorff. She actually knew Lou Piniella altogether back in she graduated the year I was born in 72.
Wow. And I wonder if – let's hope we didn't have – let's hope that later on in the 80s they didn't have any connections to pharmacies, like most places in Tampa do. In hockey, the Philadelphia Flyers won another Stanley Cup. They beat the Buffalo Sabres 4-2. Bobby Clark, of course, was the season MVP. Two new teams were added, guys. Two new teams. The Kansas City Scouts joined the NHL, and the Washington Capitals joined the league, and of course they would be around quite a bit, obviously, and are still here today, and finally won a cup a couple years ago. Of course, the Kansas City Scouts would move around a couple times. Dr. G is a Kansas City Scouts fan, maybe not directly. Jack Nicklaus won yet another Masters that year. Lou Gramm won the U.S. Open. No, not that Lou Gramm, because it's urgent. Urgent. We'll get more into the music later. Tom Watson won the British. Jack Nicklaus also won the PGA Championship and your tour money leader. We had three different winners in the horse racing Triple Crown. Foolish Pleasure won the Kentucky Derby. Master Derby won the Preakness. And Avatar, was he blue? Won the Belmont. Was it a blue horse? Four different winners in tennis. John Newcomb won the Australian Open. Bjorn Borg, one of the greatest players ever, won the French. Arthur Ashe, God rest his soul, won Wimbledon. And Manuel Orantes won the U.S. Open. In the women's, my girl Chris Evert, Chrissy, loved her. She won the French in the U.S. Open. Yvonne Goolagong won the Australian. And Billie Jean King won Wimbledon. One of the greatest fights ever took place in 1975. Just to do a little background, of course, if you remember, Muhammad Ali had to relinquish the heavyweight title because he didn't do his due diligence as an American and get into the draft. So he was stripped of his heavyweight title. Joe Frazier, of course, was champion. and he got knocked out by this guy who eventually would make a hell of a grill. And I am, of course, talking about George Foreman. Well, a year earlier in 74, Muhammad Ali won the Rumble in the Jungle in Kinshasa, Zaire. And 1 year later, once again, Muhammad Ali fought outside the U.S. to an epic crowd at Smart Araneta Coliseum in Quezon City in the Philippines. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, the Thrilla in Manila. And, of course, this was the third fight between the two. Of course, the first fight was what many consider the fight of the century at Madison Square Garden. And then, of course, they fought again, I think, later that year, maybe a year later. And this was the last one. Ali won by TKO after Frazier's second in the corner conceded the fight prior to the 15th round. Watched by a record global television audience of 1 billion viewers. Now, for 1975, guys, a billion viewers to watch one thing is amazing. Now it's whatever. but back then, 1975, including 100 million viewers watching pay-per-view in 1975, and closed-circuit theater television, and 500,000 pay-per-view buys on HBO cable. I'm assuming, Dr. G, that your father ran a cable through the kitchen and out the door and to somebody else's house to get it in the bar.
Oh, yeah, there was no way he was paying for that.
He had a guy who knew a guy. And this is another example, and we'll get more into this, guys, as we move ahead into the 70s and definitely into the 80s. Boxing, I mean, I'm a big Deontay Wilder fan, and he knocked a guy out with one punch. And I miss the days of Iron Mike when guys would get knocked out with one punch. He knocked out a guy Saturday night. And I like Deontay Wilder. But, I mean, boxing was so different. It's kind of like tennis. We'll talk more about tennis, too, as we get into the 80s. Boxing just doesn't have those personalities anymore. Whether you were an Ali fan or not, or you were a Frazier fan or Foreman or any of the middleweights back in those days or the light heavyweights. I don't know, G. It's not the same anymore. Like,
no, it's kind of like tennis. Tennis is the same way, too.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, and tennis was big with McEnroe and Connors. And all. You don't have that personality. And you're right. It's funny. It's Muhammad Ali and those guys back in the 70s, they kind of brought that WWE feel to the world of boxing back in the 70s, you know?
I mean, what are you thinking, Johnny? Bars out in Nassau County and Suffolk County watching fights through the department store windows? I'm sure, like, the Paramount Theater. So, obviously you wouldn't remember, but maybe if you looked back, I wonder if places did, like, closed circuit back then, like, in, you know, theaters and stuff. You think?
Nah, not at this time. This was, yeah. Like HBO, and wasn't even available till like the 80s, so it's still too early for that. Yeah, I think it was just a select closed circuit. But most people just waited, for like it would be like a week or two, they'd have it on a wide world of sports.
Exactly.
That's a big difference because, you know, eventually the fights would be on, on regular basic channels on the wide world of sports on ABC.
Right. They would edited down or whatever. Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Who is – so I don't even know who the world heavyweight boxing champion is right now.
Deontay Wilder. That's why I says, yeah, Deontay Wilder. He actually fought Saturday night. Well, there's two different – I mean, isn't Klitschko, I think, champion of one belt, and Deontay Wilder –
I have no idea.
Another belt, I have no idea. But Deontay Wilder is one of the heavyweight champions. He fought Brazil on Saturday night. He knocked him out in the second round with one punch. So yeah, no, as we move ahead and talk boxing, we're going to talk about some of my favorites of all time. Two of my favorite guys we'll talk about in the 80s, of course, Iron Mike Tyson, my favorite as a kid. And then one of the best middleweights of all time, Marvelous Marvin Hagler from Brockton, Massachusetts. I didn't realize he was from Massachusetts. But we'll talk more about that when we get to the 80s. Anyway, the Thrill in Manila took place in October of 75. And Ali retained, I think he was, yeah, he well, retained his heavyweight title. So, and that's pretty much it in sports. Andy, back to you. We go from the field to the small screen and a ton of great shows in the 70s. Some ended, some began.
Yeah, quickly we'll go through the some of the top shows. not much changed over the couple of years. You know, it was those sitcoms were ruling. So you had All in the Family, Sanford and Son, Chico and the Man, the new show, The Jeffersons. I wonder what that show's about. MASH, Rhoda, a couple of spinoffs in there, actually. You've got Good Times.
Look at these ratings, though.
Yeah. And then you got The Waltons, Maude, Hawaii Five-O. One big change, though. Only one movie, regular movie slot is in there. I remember when we first started, it was like five or six of the slots in the top 30 were the NBC movie, this Thursday movie, that Sunday movie. Now it's only one, the NBC Sunday Mystery Movie at 24. We said goodbye to some shows in 75. Jeopardy said goodbye after its initial run. It came back in 84, but this was the end of its initial run. Ironside said goodbye that year. The Odd Couple with, great Tony Randall and Jack Klugman.
Weird.
Yeah. Gunsmoke.
That show didn't last very long, huh? What, maybe 4 years probably?
Yeah.
The Odd Couple.
Mm-hmm. And then
they had a short but great run.
Yeah, and then Mathau and Lemon took it back over in the unofficial Odd Couple movies later on. Gunsmoke, Mannix, Kung Fu, and Adam 12 all ended. But
the Odd Couple ran, let's see, 5 seasons, 114 episodes. It started September 24th, 1970. And ended on March 7th, 1975. So pretty much first half of the decade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we had I guess it was a mid-season replacement early in the year, was Beretta. That started January. Then the aforementioned Jeffersons started. That was a tremendous show. Yeah, so while we're here, though, it'll have happened by the time everybody hears this, but did they do that live thing yet, the All in the Family Jeffersons thing? They haven't done that yet, right?
No, it's Wednesday.
No.
Wednesday.
All right, so yeah, this is dropping, I think, sometime early next week. So what do you guys think of this thing going in?
I think it's stupid.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they're not going to do, and gee, you and I have had this discussion, they're not going to do what they're supposed to do. They're going to try to water it down and make it millennial friendly, and they won't be as cutting edge. They're not going to be like Woody Harrelson's Archie. He's not going to be Archie. It's going to be
the New York accent.
They shouldn't even bother. Waste of time. What do you think?
It's something different. It's worth it. I'll give it a look. But yeah, they got that's the only thing. They got Marissa Tomei playing Edith Bingdad, who was an old housefrau, and they got milfy Marissa Tomei. That's quite an interesting casting right there.
I feel bad for Gene Stapleton.
The highest Aunt May in the history of Spider-Man.
Exactly.
Nobody ever wanted to bang Edith Bunker. Well, except for Actually, I shouldn't say that. Not to make a joke about it, but there was a hot episode where a guy tried to rape her. Yeah. Yep. And she fought him off. That was a groundbreaking episode. So stuff like that. It was a groundbreaking show in its time. But yeah. Nowadays, I don't know how hard they're going to go with as far as Archie's questionable opinions on race, etc. But we'll see. It's worth a try. At least it's something different. Norman Lear, God bless him. He's in his late hundreds and he's still firing away.
Well, yeah, the
funny thing is, what's funny about the top 30 list that you read, Andy, is that not only this tells you and I know G will appreciate this and will agree with me. To show the epic power and the weight that All in the Family had as a show, not only is that still on the list, but both its spinoffs are on the list.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, The Jeffersons was a spinoff, and
Maude.
Yeah. And speaking of, I'm my fucking head off that's listening to this. I am quoting the show before anybody loses their fucking minds. Okay. The episode where the Jeffersons actually move into the house across the street, and G and I watched this episode the other day, and we were on the floor laughing our ass off. Edith, we got to stop this. We're going to have watermelon rinds flying through the fucking window and all this other stuff. And I'm like, I think to myself, all right, yes, it was offensive because it was meant to be because that's what the show was.
Well, it was showing him being ignorant. It was actually making fun of him.
You're not going to make these jokes on this show this week. So what's the point? The whole point is to be offensive because that's what he was. It's just not going to be that way. But whatever. I agree with John in the sense that we might as well – eyeballs are going to be on it to see what they do.
Well,
but anyway,
Jefferson's George Jefferson was basically the black version of Archie Bunker.
Yeah, exactly. Pretty much.
Now, the difference between, I'll get to Maude in a minute, but I gotta pay. I'm curious your guys' thoughts on this. The Jeffersons, I have to admit, and G may disagree with me on this, but I actually liked the Jeffersons a little bit more than I liked All in the Family. And the only reason I say that is I didn't feel like the Jeffersons was as preachy as All in the Family was. Like, yes, George was ignorant, just as ignorant as Archie was, but in a different way. Like, he was stupid. Like, he you know, Norman Lear proved in that show that you don't have to be like, you know, he was trying to be fair because it's like, all right, you know white dumb ones. Everybody's got, you know, everybody's an idiot in some capacity. And that's what the Jefferson was. And, you know, where Archie had Edith, you know, George had Wheezy. And, you know, and you had Mr. Bentley was always my favorite. I don't know why, but I was like, and I didn't find the Jeffersons as preachy as on the, but any event. And then Maude, it used to make me laugh because first of all, that was a good show. It was B.R. Arthur, pre-Golden Girl. There was a term that started up from the show Maude, and it was called limousine liberal. And they said that's what Maude was. She had all these liberal platitudes, you know, pro-choice and all this, you know, all those kind of things that women in the '70s. But except when it was in her backyard, and then suddenly she's like, oh, you know, the typical one who will get on a high horse from afar. But when it was right in front of her and she had to experience it, she got all like frazzled because she couldn't handle it. That's what Maude's like kind of gag was. But they had some serious episodes. The husband was a drunk, smacked her in the mouth on the show. And
first abortion on TV.
First abortion. Yeah, she had a smoke show. Adrienne Barbeau was the daughter. And, mm-hmm.
Think about now, Good Times is a spinoff of Maude, which technically then is a spinoff of All in the Family. So,
yeah. It's a cool show. Good Times, which also debuted in 75, I believe, right? Mm-hmm. Is that 76? Oh, 75, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you didn't get to all the debuts yet. Yeah. Sorry. Well, you broke the fourth wall tonight when you said you weren't ready, so.
hey, I just anyway, went 2 weeks ago.
Jefferson's was just such an iconic show because, I don't know, I didn't find it as preachy as All in the Family. So if I had to pick my favorite of the Bunker genealogy of great sitcoms of the '70s, I'll always say the Jeffersons.
I just for me as a kid, I just thought the Jeffersons was a funnier show. That's what it came down to, the dynamics between George and Florence the maid, the housekeeper. The great Marla Gibbs. I mean, I thought that was better than, you know, the whole Archie Meathead dynamic, personally. Then you had, like, you know, the interracial couple that lived next door. That was a lot of great comedy that they could break off of there. So then we had another great sitcom come up that year. Barney Miller, set in the police precinct, I believe, in the Bronx, I think it was. Is that correct?
I thought it was Queens.
Was it?
I have to look it up.
And, you know, with the really funny funny cast, a very, very mixed up cast with Hal Linden as the lead. Then you had the great, you know, Abe Vigoda as Fish. Max Gale was on it as Wojo. Then you had Steve Landsberg as Dietrich. Ron Glass as Harris, and then Ron Carey, one of the great Mel Brooks actors, as Officer Carl Levitt, and then Jack Sue as Yamana. He actually
died during the show.
Yeah, he died, I think, after the first season, I think.
But, fourth season?
No, well, did he?
Let's see. Jack Sue. Midway through season 5.
Yeah. I love Wojo. hey, Barn.
E6th Street in the Village.
Ah.
So it was in Manhattan. It was a Manhattan district. It was a Manhattan police station. E6th Street in Greenwich Village.
Ah. Yes.
So there we go.
Then we had a SWAT debut that year in February, and then another Mary Tyler Moore spinoff, Phyllis, starring the great Cloris Leachman. Match Game PM. That's kind of amazing. You watch that nowadays, and it's like, how different time was everybody smoking and probably, you know, drunk as a skunk. And then you got another very, you know, legendary show. Welcome Back, Kotter.
Love that show.
Mm-hmm. The Sweat Hogs, you know, gave John Travolta his big break. And then a big-time BBC show, Fawlty Towers, debuted.
Mm-hmm. Before we continue, Mr. Atherton, Dr. G, why don't you tell everyone what school was in the opening credits of Welcome Back, Kotter?
Well, that's based on where my family's from, Bensonhurst, Brooklyn, and the school is my dad's school. It's actually New Utrecht High School, but I guess what do they call it? Ecannon High or something like that. I forget what it was in the show. But basically, my dad was a sweat hog, so I tell him it's about him. But that show was basically on my dad's high school in Brooklyn, because I believe that's with the Gabe Kaplan is from Brooklyn.
Yeah.
That's where the awful idea. I think he's from the Benson Earth neighborhood. So. I always love seeing the show and the big sign when they're on the highway, you know, that Brooklyn would be the fourth largest city in the United States if it wasn't actual. It was its own city. So, I love that show for that reason, just because, you know, reminds me of my family.
It was James Buchanan High. And actually, Gabe Kaplan, G, went to New Utrecht.
Yep, that's right.
There you go.
That's why they put the picture in it. Yep. But that show is great. I mean,
never tell you about my uncle.
Your uncle?
Yeah, your uncle. other great shows. Good Morning America debuted that year. She will always, as great as Gal Gadot is, Linda Carter is always going to be Wonder Woman to me. And that she's
fucking Machi, let me tell you right now.
She debuted that year. And you could hear that theme in your head right now. And just, yep. Yeah, she was Wonder Woman. There's no other ifs, ands, or buts about it.
Yeah.
And then One Day at a Time also debuted later that year in December. But the big show that debuted, and is still on the air today, October 11th, 1975, with the host, first host ever, George Carlin, and a guest, Andy Kaufman. It was live from New York, and it was Saturday Night. That's right, Saturday Night Live debuted, you know, what is that, 44 years ago, almost. And still on the air to this day. I mean, that's incredible. I mean, just... That first year, that awesome cast. And this is, I believe, the show where Andy Kaufman did the Mighty Mouse bit. Where he just
Here I come to save the day!
Thank you very much.
You know that George Carlin was supposed to be the regular host. Mm-hmm. They weren't supposed to do guest hosts. He was going to be the regular – he was supposed to be the regular host. Oh. He was supposed to open with the monologue and then just do the skits the rest of the show.
Wow.
But they thought – but then eventually Lorne Michaels thought it was better to have like the hot actor or the hot TV star or the hot athlete at the time. The host. So.
Yeah.
Pretty impressive.
Yeah, it is. I mean
– As a matter of fact, before we continue, because mm-hmm. we like to do this kind of thing, let's take a look and see. I wonder if there's a list on Wiki of – who the guests of every the first season were. Let's see. Season one. Let's see.
I think Candace Bergen was in there somewhere, I think.
All right. They're not ready. All right. So here were the guests. Here was the season one guests. These are the hosts, not the musical guests. George Carlin was the first one. Paul Simon, Rob Reiner, Candace Bergen, Robert Klein, Lily Tomlin, Richard Pryor, Candace Bergen again, Elliot Gould, Buck Henry, Peter Cook, and Dudley Moore. They were Dudley Moore in his movie career.
Peter Cook.
Peter Cook, yes. Dick Cabot. Cook. Oh yeah, he's exciting. Yeah, there are a lot of cucks that are they're less funny than Dick Cabot. Peter Boyle, Desi Arnaz, Joe Clayburgh, Anthony Perkins, Ron Nesson, Raquel Welch, Madeline Kahn, Diane Cannon, Buck Henry again, Elliot Gould again, Luis Lasser, and the season finale, July of 76, was Kris Kristofferson. Among the musical guests, I won't read them all, but among the musical guests, Billy Preston and Janice Ian were the first musical guest ever. Let's see. ABBA debuted on American television. Anne Murray, Bill Withers, and Tony Basil. So in the pre-Mickey days.
Wow.
Neil Sedaka. Come on, G, you love Neil Sedaka.
No doubt.
Desi Arnaz and Desi Arnaz Jr. Obviously, he sang in his own show. Patti Smith, Carly Simon, Leon and Mary Russell, Leon Redbone, Gordon Lightfoot, and Rita Coolidge. So not the sexiest amount of musical guests in season one, but yeah. So episode four was when Chevy Chase first impersonated Gerald Ford. I'm trying to find did any of the real big debuts like the Bees, the Samurai. Chibaga, Chibaga, Chibaga. I think it debuted at some point.
Yeah, Nick's Creek Diner, I think it was called.
Yep, the Blues Brothers in the Bees costumes perform I'm a King Bee with Howard Shore and the Ali Bee Band. Yes. So there you go. So I think we're gonna track that guy. I think we're gonna do that, Andy, if you don't mind. I think that'd be fun. Every episode we'll check the season of SNL and see if the guests were cool and the musical guests were cool. So.
Yeah. All right.
So season one.
First season was dominated by Chevy Chase.
Yep, and then he left. And then he's like, I'm too big for you guys. So, but,
Hollywood came a-calling.
Hollywood came a-calling, and then he was replaced. Mm-hmm. And when we get to season two, in the next episode, we'll tell you who replaced him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Led to a long-standing feud.
And then, all right, and then at the other end of the day, Saturday morning cartoons – you know, not much changed over from year to year, but we had, you know, Pebbles and Bam Bam were still there, the Bugs Bunny Roadrunner Hour, Scooby-Doo, Where Are You?, Fat Albert and the Cosby Kids, and then some Croft the Superstars. We had the Far Out Space Nuts.
Yes.
Bob Denver's follow-up to Gilligan's Island. Valley of the Dinosaurs, Hong Kong Phooey was still on the air. The Tom and Jerry Grape Ape Show.
Yes, look great.
I love Grape Ape. Maybe a future debate, a battle of cartoon gorillas. We'll have Grape Ape versus Megilla.
Just on Megilla, yep.
The New Adventures of Gilligan. Speed Buggy was still there. American Bandstand was on the air. Even though it's not a cartoon, it was Saturday morning. Sigmund and Sea Monsters. Secret Life of Waldo Kitty. Land of the Lost. Pink Panther. Return to the Planet of the Apes, which was animated. Josie and the Pussycats, Yogi's Gang, Lassie's Rescue Rangers, My Favorite Martians, Genie, Wheelie and the Chopper Bunch, the Jetsons, and then also the Super Friends. Now, this was the incarnation where they had the two teenagers with the dog.
Yep. So, it was Marvin.
Yes, Marvin.
And what the hell was the girl's name? Wonder Dog, I think, was the dog's name. Mm-hmm. And then Marvin was the kid, was the boy's, and what was the girl's name? Wendy.
Yes, Wendy and Marvin.
Marvin and Wendy, and I don't remember the dog's name, but and it was a small group. It was just Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, and Aquaman.
I didn't realize.
Yeah, that was pre Wonder Twin Powers activate.
And that was pre Challenges. Was it the Challenge of the Super Friends?
Yes,
that was my favorite incarnation because that was when they battled the Legion of Doom every episode.
Oh yeah. Do you remember the name of the, you know who narrated the Super Friends episodes? Ted Knight.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
Hall of Justice.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much was Ted Baxter doing the narrating the show.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
And on this show, the characters of Plastic Man and Green Arrow made their first animated appearances.
Yes, he did. Yep.
Now, there's been talk about a Plastic Man movie. I got to tell you, if they don't get that kid who plays Ned and Spider-Man to be Hula Hula, there's something wrong with them. Oh, Plas, I'm a scared. Yeah, and then, we'll talk about the other incarnations later on as we go through. But, you know, I love, that was one of my favorites. That's why I grew up a DC fan. That's why I'm so disappointed in the shit movies they put out. Well, they're getting better, though, I gotta tell you. But, that's going to bring a close to the TV section, and that's going to bring a close to the first half of our show tonight. So 75, not as dull a year as we thought it was going to be. But when we come back, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to dive into the worlds of news, music, and movies. So, with Scott Criscolo, J. Arsenio D'Amato, and George Ribolino, I'm Andy Atherton. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place Two Nations, JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceTwoNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. The Place Two Nation Wrestling feed. We dive into the topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation Pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content, offering tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all of these current shows, plus archives of our previous podcasts over the past 8 years as well, by subscribing to our feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others available at PlaceMation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using www.placetomination.com/Amazon while doing your online shopping. And be sure to join us at our forum at Bigelow34.proboards.com for all sorts of wrestling, sports, and pop culture discussion each and every day, where you can make your voice heard. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceTomination.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Everybody was kung fu fighting. Those kids were fast as lightning. In fact, it was a little bit frightening. But they fought with expert timing.
Welcome back, Place B Nation, here on the Pop Feed, to the next episode of the Year in Pop, 1975. I am Scott Criscolo with Andy Atherton, of course, the doctor, Dr. G. George Ribolino, and J. Arsenio D'Amato. We have talked trends. We have talked TV, sports, and all sorts of fun stuff. And we got more to come. But first, let's talk about what's going on our two feeds, including this one, Mr. Atherton. Tell us what is going on the Pop Feed.
That's right. Always a busy week on the Pop Feed with something for everybody. Stephen Kelly celebrated 1 year of Songs with Friends by live watching some classic NSYNC. Then we got a heavy dose of hoops talk. Mr. D'Amato, you and the Cowboy on This Week in Sports. You guys were talking a little NBA Finals, I'm sure. Lots of
yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Yes. After every round, we do our crappy predictions. And...
what's your batting average over there with you and the Cowboy?
I should speak for myself. Mine is kind of low. Cowboys is a lot better.
All right. And then we had Adam and Andrew over on the NBA team show. The lovely Miranda Berthold joined me for Pup Goes the Movies. We discussed Pokemon Detective Pikachu. I know, Scott, you were eagerly awaiting that that pod to drop. But yeah, lots of Pop Goes the Movies coming soon. I don't think we're going to get a John Wick 3 one out, but there will definitely be an Aladdin, there will be a Rocket Man, there will be a Godzilla King of Monsters, just to name some of the May releases. Our friend Glennie Bunn, the Glenn Butler podcast, Our Spectacular, has returned. And Glenn and Scott are breaking down Star Trek Discovery Season 2. Then we had
season.
I've never watched the show, but everybody I've talked to about it has said very good things about it. Then we had the heart-traveling fanboys. They're going off the page and talking about Marvel Ultimate Alliance. And also, stay tuned for the giant-sized edition of the show coming soon. It will include past guests and revealing of PTBN's composite rankings of all 22 MCU movies. Now, Scott, I know you recently did it on Main Event. You went over your list. Maybe I'll do mine because I sent one in.
Okay.
So ours are quite different, actually, after I listened to yours. I think I'd probably go along the side of Nate. But I had, like, my bottom was like everybody else's. You know, I had The Incredible Hulk at 22, Thor the Dark World, 21, Iron Man 2. Then I had Thor at 19, Iron Man 3 at 18, Doctor Strange, surprisingly, at 17.
Oh, that's low. Wow.
Yeah, Ant-Man and Wasp at 16, Black Panther at 15. Avengers Age of Ultron at 14, Ant-Man at 13, Captain Marvel at 12, Spider-Man Homecoming at 11, Captain America the First Avenger at 10, the First Iron Man at 9, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 at 8, Captain America Winter Soldier at 7, Avengers Infinity War at 6. And my top 5 were The Avengers from 2012, Guardians of the Galaxy the first one, Thor Ragnarok at number 3, number 2 Captain America Civil War, and I actually put Endgame as my number 1 cuz I just saw that movie again and I went for the final battle mostly, but I just loved that movie so much. It was just
tremendous.
It was just such an undertaking and an achievement. But yeah, so if hopefully you got your rankings in and you're part of the list, if not, it'll still be a good listen. Check out Nick and Greg and a bevy of Place to Be Nation pup and comics experts on that show. Scott, what's going over where you mostly reside over on the wrestling feed?
Well, my PIC, Mr. Zero, and Chad Campbell back in the wrestling war zone as they discuss what was going on Raw and Nitro during the week of January 8th, 1996. In the fourth episode of Row 1, Seat 1, my good friend and guy who got me shit-faced, Ben Zanny, chats with his buddies Tommy and Gator. Yeah, Tommy and Gator. It was Gator that probably had that stuff in the jar. Gator talks about his recent experience of promoting an indie show in the Washington, D.C. area. It's old school. It's like Vince Sr. doing Capital Wrestling. JR and I welcomed in Jambalaya Jake Williams to break down the April 24th, 1989 MSG House Show featuring a big WrestleMania main event rematch. And finally, of course, myself, the Godfather Nate Milton, and the tardy Steve Willie due to typical shitty Wisconsin Wi-Fi. We previewed both Money in the Bank, which happened last night as we're recording, and this coming weekend's Double or Nothing on the newest edition of the main event. Of course, check out our social media pages and message board at bigelow34.proboards.com for information on joining our GWWE pay-per-view and TV match ever project. Get in on the conversation today. Start researching your list. And, yeah, got a long year for that. Plenty of matches. Plenty of great things. So there you go. The PTBN pop feed and the PTBN wrestling feed. All right, Mr. Atherton, let's get back to 1975. And what was going on in the news headlines, my friend?
Well, you know, like we've said, it's kind of an interim year, I guess, a mid-year. Like, not a lot going on. But the Vietnam War did end that year as communist forces took Saigon and the South Vietnam surrendered unconditionally. The IRA did a number of attacks in the UK. The Apollo and Soyuz had a joint mission up there in the space, along with you know, all that other stuff going on up there. And then Patty Hearst becomes most wanted.
The Empire built the Death Star?
That's right. Well,
that was the greatest way you said that. Yeah, they went up there and, yeah, they did some stuff, yeah.
All that stuff going on up there.
It's a bodega.
Well, you know, you kind of need that stuff, right?
That's true.
Then we had Patty Hearst, the newspaper heiress. She's found in a San Francisco apartment and arrested for armed robbery in September of 75. She had been kidnapped in Berkeley in February 74. In April, she sent letters to the media stating she was joining the leftist group SLA, the Siamese Liberation Army, of her own free will. Later that month, a surveillance camera took a photo of her participating in an armed robbery of a San Francisco bank, making her a wanted criminal by the FBI. Following her capture, she went on trial for crimes and was found guilty and sentenced to 7 years of prison. She served 2 years and had her sentence commuted. She was later pardoned by President Bill Clinton.
And then she banged him. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. Did I step all out? incidentally, on a side note, oh, wait, say the last thing on your list, and then I want to ask a question. But go ahead.
The last thing on my list was...
Did you mention the bankruptcy?
No, I didn't. I was getting to that. Okay. I went to another site. And then also, New York City avoided bankruptcy when President Ford signed a $2.3 billion loan. That's amazing.
Well, of course, there's that infamous, I don't know if it was the Post or the News when it said Ford the city dropped dead. Because guess what, Dr. G? What bankrupted New York City? The unions.
Yep.
Are you fucking stunned? They're going to bankrupt it now, too.
I ride on such clean trains every day.
I can only imagine, guys, for you guys, you G, at the time living in Brooklyn, and of course you, Johnny, out on the island. I don't know if it affected you as much, John, because you know Long Island's kind of its own entity. But I don't know. Do you think the outer boroughs were affected by it? Do you think? I mean, you were only what, two? But I mean, I don't know. Do you think that? I mean, as we get down through the timeline, you'll talk about when you moved to Florida, but. Do you think it affected the outer boroughs? The fact that, like, the actual city, like Manhattan, probably was a fucking toilet. I mean, I know that all the boroughs are part of New York City. I understand that.
The boroughs all make up the city.
I know, but I mean, it seemed like Manhattan was the one that was the biggest toilet, and then the boroughs kind of, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, from what I hear and you know things you see on TV, it looked like the whole city was just the toilet at that time. To be honest.
Long Island really wasn't affected, right?
We're not a great time for New York.
Yeah. Long Island really wasn't affected, right, John? They kind of were on their own island. No pun intended.
Yeah, definitely. It was like being in a whole different state than New York City. But that's New York in general. It's so big that there's, you know, every place is different. You can be like, it's like being in another state. So.
Well, think about it.
New York didn't really come back until the mid 90s, really. Mm-hmm. Where they cleaned it up.
I mean, even the 80s was a toilet. Not as bad as the 90s, not as bad as the 70s, but of course, I mean, think about it, John. You and I are watching a tremendous show on HBO. Season 3 will be coming up in the fall, and that's The Deuce. And it pretty much, I mean, we think about Times Square now. What's the one thing that scares you about Times Square now? Those fucking weirdos with the Elmo outfits on trying to rip you off. But forget about it. Back then, go ahead, John.
And a bunch of buzzed out weirdos walking around Times Square in a haze. That's just talking about you guys at WrestleMania.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yes, I had to carry around frickin' frack. They were looking. I'm surprised if I had them lead me, we would walk to Cleveland. But you know, go to the 70s and think about it. Times Square was fucking pimps and whores and drug dealers and peep shows and porn shops and trash on the sidewalk. I mean, it was literally like the bottom of a toilet. It's amazing. It's amazing how different. I don't know. Maybe it was the charm. It was something about the charm of New York in the 70s, even though it was a big fucking, you know, bottom of a shoe. You know, we'll talk about that as we move ahead through the back end of the 70s. One of my favorite movies we'll talk about in the later 70s, The Warriors, is a great snapshot of, you know, shit New York in the late 70s. But anyway, I just wanted to ask our resident, you know, borough guys what they thought of you know, how New York could have possibly been back then. But yeah, it was fucking unions and big government, and they, you know, Abe Beame and those guys, and we'll get more into the New York City government, Andy, when we get to 77, because the Summer of Sam was also the year of the big mayor race that would end up getting won by the first New York mayor I most of us ever remember, Ed Koch.
Yes. I highly recommend looking up Sunday in New York. And it's Sunday spelled like the ice cream, S-U-N-D-A-E. It's the Claymation short they did with Ed Cott.
Oh, right.
Ed Cott singing New York, New York.
Yep. Right. Actually, there's a great documentary about Ed Koch on Netflix that's actually very, very good. And I highly recommend it. And it's about him. It's about that election in the 70s and you know, how he was like the face of the 80s kind of thing. And I highly recommend it.
All right, cool. That pretty much closes the news section. So, Scott, why don't you tell us what was going on in the world of music?
Well, in the world of music, Mr. Atherton,
yes.
We had a lot of great stuff in 70. 75 was actually a very good year for music, and also particularly a very good year for albums. Here was the Billboard Hot – we won't go Hot 100. I'll go from 20 to 1 quickly. At number 20, at 17, Janis Ian. I don't know why it's to Janis Joplin. I don't know who did that billboard. Number 19, He Don't Love You Like I Love You by Tony Orlando and Dawn. Come on. Gee, tell me the Tony Orlando wasn't in the jukebox. Come on.
Yeah, probably.
Tony Orlando and Dawn. Number 18, Hey, Hey, You Won't Play, another Somebody Done Somebody Wrong song, B.J. Thomas. Oh, yeah. Ballroom Blitz by Sweet. We know that from some younger listeners who remember that from Wayne's World, the remake by – yep. Black Water by the Doobie Brothers at 16. Oh, God, what a great song. Kung Fu Fighting by Carl Douglas. Everybody was kung fu fighting. Loving You by Minnie Riperton. Although most newer, younger listeners would know Loving You by John Stamos' younger brother in the first season of South Park, where he sang the Hit the Note So High He Blew a Cow's Head Up.
I remember a Nutty Professor, Eddie Murphy, singing that.
Number 13, Best of My Love by the Eagles. As John mentioned earlier in the show, the Eagles had a great year in 75. Jive Talking by the Bee Gees at number 12, as they kind of got out of their doldrums of the early 70s, and we'll be talking a lot about the BFGs for the rest of the decade. Thank God I'm a Country Boy by one of your favorite guys, Dr. G, John Denver. Oh, wait, you killed John Denver. Never mind. At number 10, One of These Nights by the Eagles. Number 9, Laughter in the Rain by Neil Sedaka. Number 8, Fame by David Bowie. Number 7, Shining Star by Earth, Wind, and Fire. Love that song. Love that song. Number 6, Some Kind of Wonderful, Grand Funk Railroad. Number 5, tell me this isn't a Brooklyn song. It might be a Long Island song, too. I know he's from Jersey. I know that. But My Eyes Adored You by Frankie Valli. Oh.
My eyes
adored you. Oh, I never laid a hand. I had that 45. Number 4, Before the Next Teardrop Falls by Freddie Fender. Number 3, Philadelphia Freedom by Elton John. Number 2, I think Dr. G, I think this is one of Mrs. G's favorite songs, Rhinestone Cowboy.
Oh, wow.
I'd love to see Roger Rhinestone. So that'd be great. I want to call him Rhinestone Cowboy. What do you think, John? I think we should get Cowboy to get some rhinestones. Rhinestone Cowboy, Glenn Campbell. And number 1, Johnny, you mentioned it earlier in the show, Love Will Keep Us Together by the Captain and Tennille. God rest the captain's soul. Passed away.
Yeah. Yes. Speaking of John Denver, I wasn't in the library, but the latest episode of Laughing Theater, we had Dumb and Dumber, myself and Jennifer Smith. And I remember there was a line in that movie, you know, when they get to Denver, you know, Harry's like, I expected the Rocky Mountains to be a little more rockier than this. And Lloyd goes, I was thinking the same thing. That John Denver's full of shit, man.
Yes. The Grammys that year in 75, of course, this is from the songs from 74. Record of the year was Olivia Newton-John with Honestly Love You. Album of the year was Fulfilling This First Finale, Stevie Wonder. Song of the year was The Way We Were. And Barbra Streisand, Shoot Me in the Head. And Best New Artist was Marvin Hamlisch, who, of course, we'll talk about a couple years later, who he did the great soundtrack for the great James Bond film, Spy Love Me. Top albums, Johnny, killer albums in 1975. Wish You Were Here came out by Pink Floyd. Probably my favorite. I think it's my favorite Pink Floyd album, I have to say. Wish You Were Here. I think Shine On You, Crazy Diamonds on that. I don't know. Is Brain Damage on that one, John?
Yeah, I think so.
Is Brain Damage on Wish You Were Here? That's a tremendous album. Love Wish You Were Here. Blood on the Tracks by Bob Dylan. Born to Run, which was, after a couple of near misses, Born to Run was the epic album by Bruce Springsteen. It's got Born to Run. I think it's Jungle Land is on there. Let me think. What else is on that album? Help me out, Dr. G. What else is on Born to Run? I know Jungle Land's on there. Let me see.
Hungry Heart?
No, Hungry Heart was years later.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, that was in the 80s.
That was
The River. Yeah, Hungry Heart is on The River. Yeah.
It was Thunder Road, 10th Avenue, Freeze Out.
Oh, that's a great song. Yes.
Night, Backstreets, yep. Born to Run, She's the One, Meeting Across the River, and Jungle Land.
Jungle Land is an awesome song. I love Jungle Land. I love Thunder Road. My favorite song from them, I think, came out after this. That's Rosalita, but I think that came out after this album. So that came out in 1975, Born to Run. Also coming out that year, a band that I'm now totally back in love with after seeing Bohemian Rhapsody. Of course, I'm speaking of Queen. And speaking of Bohemian Rhapsody, the album that song is on, A Night at the Opera, came out that year. I think my favorite line ever still is of that movie, and I have it on Blu-ray, is when Mike Myers is sitting in the desk and he's like, Biz what? And then in that Freddy voice, he goes, Bismillah. I don't know. I love that. Rami Malek was a fucking stud in that movie. There's no doubt about it. I cannot wait till he's the Bond villain. It's going to be tremendous in the next Bond movie. So let's see. On A Night at the Opera is A Death on Two Legs, Lazy on a Sunny Afternoon, You're My Best Friend is on that album. I'm In Love with My Car, which is Roger Taylor, and that's, of course, a running joke in the movie, that song, I'm In Love with My Car. And Bohemian
Killer Rhapsody. Queen?
And Killer Queen. No, Killer Queen was on the previous album, I think.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Yeah, no, Killer Queen was on the previous album. Bohemian Rhapsody and You're My Best Friend are the two big ones on that album. So, one of the greatest albums of all time, undoubtedly. My favorite album from this band, probably because it has two of my favorite songs ever from them, and that is Physical Graffiti by one of my three favorite artists of all time. Of course, I'm talking about Led Zeppelin. Two of my favorite songs on that album, Kashmir, which is my favorite. I think it's like probably my number two favorite song of all time. And another great song on that album called 10 Years Gone. If you guys don't know that song, I highly recommend listening to it. It's pretty damn great. So Physical Graffiti came out that year. That was a double album, actually. And I'm pretty sure that was the first album. In fact, I can almost guarantee that was the first album off of Zeppelin's personal label, Swan Song. So they took 2 years off. Remember, as I mentioned earlier, Robert Plant got in a car accident, fucked his foot up. And then they went to Bronior, which was a cottage in Wales, and they did this song. The songs on this album, are, Custard Pie. I mean, this is just one fucking powerhouse after another. Custard Pie, The Rover, In My Time of Dying, Houses of the Holy, Trampled Underfoot, Kashmir, In the Light, Bronior, Down by the Seaside, 10 Years Gone, Night Flight, The Wanton Song, Sick Again. I mean, just one, just incredible cut after another on that album. But Kashmir is my personal favorite. And yes, so Dr. G, there are plenty of 8-minute and 11-minute songs on this album because I know that you love long songs. So, Horses by Patti Smith came out that year. Another Green World by Brian Eno. And then arguably one of my favorite albums of all time came out that year. And that was the third album by Aerosmith. I am talking about, of course, Toys in the Attic, which had, of course, the title track, Toys in the Attic, but also two of the most recognizable Aerosmith songs of all time, that being, of course, Walk This Way and Sweet Emotion, came off Toys in the Attic. Big 10-inch record was on that album. Adam's Apple was on that album as well. And that is the first of what, to me, would be back-to-back two of the greatest rock albums ever. Because the following year, when we get to 1976, we will talk about maybe one of the five greatest just pure rock albums ever, and that is Rocks. We had not one but two Elton John albums that came out that year, Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy and Rock of the Westies. This guy was a machine, at least in the 70s. My God. Your boy, Dr. G, Billy Joel, took the year off. just want to mention that to all the Billy Joel fans. Billy took the year off. I think he was in between, right? Well, let's see, 76, right? He's probably doing Turnstiles right now, I would think, right? He's in the midst of recording Turnstiles, which would be the last album he would do without Phil Ramone. We'll get more into Phil Ramone and Billy's collaborations in a couple of episodes. Let's see. Any other – John, any other albums I'm not thinking of? Great albums that came out in 75?
No, I just I want you to gloss over Captain Fantastic and Brown Deer Cowboy. That's one of Elton's best.
It is. Absolutely, it's one of Elton's best.
Someone Saved My Life Tonight, Bitterfingers, one banger after another.
It is, absolutely. No, I agree 100%. Let me see. Fly By Night by Rush, just so we get a little deeper into the prog rock. Let's see. Bowie's Young Americans, the album that Fame was on, as I mentioned. Let's see. Song for America by Kansas. That album came out that year. Welcome to My Nightmare, Alice Cooper. Dressed to Kill by Kiss. Chicago 8 by Chicago. Nothing Fancy, Lynyrd Skynyrd came out that year. Let's see. Katie Lied, Steely Dan. Let's see. Beach Boys had an album. It was a compilation album. Stampede by the Doobie Brothers. Straight Shooter by Bad Company. Tremendous album. Let's see. The Captain and Tennille, as mentioned, Love Will Keep Us Together came out. The Rolling Stones had two albums. Metamorphosis, which was actually an outtakes album. Jefferson Starship actually had Red Octopus, which had a couple of good cuts. Johnny, you mentioned this album earlier in the show. One of These Nights by the Eagles. Also a tremendous album as well. So a lot of good pop rock that came out in 75. KC Sunshine Band's debut album as, not their debut, but the incarnation we know very well of this band, and that is Fleetwood Mac. The first album with Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks, and of course this album. The album Fleetwood Mac had the epic song Rhiannon was on that album. So,
You know, there were some other notable songs if we just skip through the 100. The Hustle came out that year.
The Hustle.
Lady Marmalade came out.
Yes.
Why Can't We Be Friends, which is featured in the Hobbs and Shaw thing. We had, Jackie Blue came out. Magic by Pilot. It's magic. And then we had Sister Golden Hair by America.
Yep, I love that song.
Yeah, a lot of famous one hit quitters on
quitters.
Well, Barry Manilow had a bunch of hits in 75. Mandy,
that's Dr. G song. Mandy,
Mandy.
Barry ain't a one hit quitter. Barry had a lot of them.
Barry White, one of my favorite Barry White songs of all time. You're the first, the last. My everything. Do, 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 do. Let's see what else we had here. We had Lady by Styx. Aforementioned Casey and the Sunshine Band. They did a little dance. They made a little love. They got down tonight.
Yep.
Album.
Yep.
You Are So Beautiful by Joe Cocker.
Oh, great song. Oh, my God. Tremendous song.
Feel Like Making Love by Bad Company came out there.
Yep, that was on Straight Shooter. Yep, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, lots of good stuff. Killer Queen. What was the other one? The Rockford Files theme was actually number 85 that year by Mike Post.
I didn't realize the show was out yet, was it? I guess it came out the year before. That's right. We talked about it in the previous episode, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, there was a lot of good stuff. And the number 100 song, Get Dancing by Disco Tex and the Sexolettes.
Is that the underground name of Geek and Sassy?
Lord. It's not a Burn movie.
Actually, an epic breakup or a guy leaving a band in music history changed the course of this band because it was on August 23rd of 1975 that Peter Gabriel officially left Genesis.
Wow.
And embarked on his solo career. And, of course, Phil Collins, who was already in the band, but he was just playing drums, would take over at lead singer. And they, of course, opened up. They kind of got out of their prog rock, kind of artsy music, and kind of jumped into the mainstream. It took them a couple of albums. My favorite back-to-back Genesis albums is Duke and Abacab, but we'll get to those albums in the early 80s. And I believe, Mr. Atherton, that is it for music. I think I went on long enough. Plenty of great songs, plenty of great albums in 1975. Well, you're just pissed because for once your guy didn't do an album and you feel guilty because you killed John Denver. So there you go. Anyway, we'll talk more about that off air, Andy, about G being acquitted for John Denver's death.
Oh, okay.
All right. So there we go. So now, finally, to wrap up the show, let us go to the big screen.
Mm-hmm.
Because 1975 was, as you mentioned at the beginning of the program, Mr. Atherton, a time when movies changed for good.
Yeah.
Or yours.
Yeah. So, but first, let's talk about the Oscars that was held early in 1975. These were movies released in 1974. Your best picture was The Godfather, Part 2. actually, Chinatown and The Godfather Part 2 had 11 nominations that night. Godfather Part 2 had 6 wins, including Best Picture. Also, Best Director, Francis Ford Coppola. Best Actor went to Mr. Art Carney for Harry and Tonto. Best Actress went to Ellen Burstyn for Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. Best Supporting Actor went to Robert De Niro for The Godfather Part 2. And Best Supporting Actress went to Ingrid Bergman for Murder on the Orient Express. There were 4 hosts that year of the Oscars. It was Bob Hope, Shirley MacLaine, Sammy Davis Jr., and Frank Sinatra.
So, really? Mm-hmm. Sinatra actually hosted?
I'm sure he was up there for like one segment. He's like, I'll do my bit, and that's it. Sammy, you got to do the rest of the shit. So some other notes from that year. George Lucas formed Industrial Light and Magic in order to create necessary special effects for his upcoming Star Wars films. Wonder what those movies are going to do. I don't know. Little indie movies, I don't think they're going to do well at all. Sneak Previews, the first American film review show premiered, which the careers launched the careers of critics Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert. The film version of The Who's Tommy premiered in London that year as well. So before we get to the top 10 domestic gross ranking, we'll talk about some other movies that came out that year. We had Rollerball. The Hindenburg, Escape to Witch Mountain. That was the time when Disney was still making those live-action movies with the kids. The Day of the Locust, Nashville, Rooster Cogburn, Death Race 2000, and Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Now, I don't know if you guys are Python fans or not, but I didn't really watch Python until a few years ago, and it just wasn't for me. As much as I love a lot of British humor, it just didn't resonate
with you. G loves British people in general. I like.
I said I don't like the accent.
I don't like the way they talk.
Hey, what are these guys doing with this funny accent? You know what I'm saying? Hey, what's going on here?
Exactly.
I actually, I own Holy Grail. Holy Grail is a great movie, and I actually have the documentary on the history of Monty Python too. That's actually very good. Yes, their humor. You kind of gotta. I think their movies were funnier than the show. The show was a little more niche, I think. So you kind of had to get it to like it. But the movies they tried to be a little more well-rounded on humor-wise. So like Holy Grail and eventually Life of Brian and those were actually legitimately funny. The TV show, you kind of had to get it. And if you didn't get it, you wouldn't get it. If that makes any sense. You know what I mean? You kind of had to wrap your head around it. And if you didn't, then you didn't get it. But the movies were a little more mainstream, the humor was. So okay. That's just my opinion on that.
John, were you going to say something about Monty Python?
Oh, no. Monty Python and the Holy Grail is tremendous.
It is.
Big fan of that. It's hilarious. Maybe one day on the Laughing Theater it might be a... Maybe it'll change your mind if you watch it with somebody.
Yeah,
oh, look,
okay.
Look at that. He's calling you out.
Everybody's
challenging you.
I'm telling you. I'll give it another shot. I mean, I did watch that and Life of Brian. I don't know. Maybe it was just because I was in the middle of working out back then. I wasn't. Sometimes if a movie didn't get my attention, my mind wandered. But I'm willing to revisit movies that, I didn't get or resonate the first time. Because you never know. Sometimes things are better on the second viewing.
True.
You know, there's several movies that, like, there's one, I can't talk off the top of my head, but there's one movie, like, every time I watch it, I just love it even more. But so the top 10 that year, we had at number 10, we had Aloha, Bobby, and Rose. And number 9, The Apple Dumpling Gang.
Oh, I love that movie.
Starring Don Knotts and the recently departed Tim Conway.
Yes.
Tremendous. One of my favorite comedians of all time. Mm-hmm. Number 8 was Funny Lady. Ugh. And number 7 was 3 Days of the Condor.
That's a good movie, actually, if you've never seen it.
No.
Robert Rose with better movies. Mm-hmm. Good spy thriller.
Number 6 was Return of the Pink Panther. Number 5 was Shampoo. Number 4, Dog Day Afternoon.
Oh, my God. What a movie. What a movie. Another home run for John Cazale.
John Cazale, yep.
God rest his soul. That fucking guy, anytime he was on a camera, pure fucking gold. Pure gold.
He retired with a 1,000 batting percentage.
Yep.
Yeah.
One bad movie that guy was ever in.
I got a great cast. Pacino, Charles Durning, great cast.
Yep.
And a movie at number 3 that's on one of the top movies of my shame list, movies I should have seen that I haven't, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Andy, that's pathetic. I got it right here on my shelf. You got to come over. I got the digibook right here. We got to see that.
I know. You got to come up to the new digs here with the 65-inch TV here. Come on.
Yeah, no, I got to bring it over. That's pathetic. Oh, my God.
Danny DeVito, Christopher Lloyd. Yep. In the early stages, come on, not to mention Nicholson and
Louise Fletcher as one of the greatest bad guys ever, Nurse Ratched. Oh, my God.
I don't think that'll be on Laughing Theater, will it, guys?
Believe it or not, there are some humorous scenes, believe it
or
not.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, Nicholson is a tremendous performance.
Yeah.
And one of the famous lines is, she's kind of a cunt, ain't she, Doc?
Yep.
And number 2, the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
I have that on Blu-ray too, and I've seen it, but that's not one I ever saw in theaters.
Oh, okay.
That's the infamous one where you go to like midnight showings, and you know,
just up, you bring toast.
Women are making out, and people are throwing breakfast food at you, and mm-hmm. It's crazy.
That's how it became popular, because initially it wasn't that successful, and it blew up due to those midnight showings where people would watch it like multiple times. And like you said, Scott, they would bring, let's have a toast, and people would bring toast and throw it at the screen and stuff like that. And also off the strength of the soundtrack, which was tremendous, which is probably better than the movie itself. But the soundtrack, epic songs, and Tim Curry, great performance by Tim Curry.
Tim Curry, tremendous.
And then at number 1 was a movie that changed everything by a director that changed movies. That's right. This was the quote unquote the first ever Hollywood blockbuster. And we're talking about the great, I guess you call it a thriller. I don't know if you call it a horror movie or action adventure, but we're talking about Jaws, starring Roy Scheider, Robert Shaw, Richard Dreyfuss. It became their highest grossing movie of all time instantly. First movie to earn $100 million in domestic box office, and just one of my favorite movies of all time. I have seen so many making of shows about this, and it was kind of a good thing the shark didn't work, because we wouldn't have had as good a movie, I think. I think it, Spielberg, it made, I saw this as a kid, and it scared the living shit out of me to go in the water. Like, I didn't learn how to swim until I was like in fourth grade, and I think this movie is one of the reasons. I mean, Jaws 2 was on the other day. Not terrible, not great by any means. Like, it's a good movie, and then it just went downhill from there. Forget about the rest of the Jaws. But, yeah, the first Jaws, 1975, tremendous, tremendous movie. It's a movie I could watch over and over and over and quote it actually a lot, too. It's very quotable. What about you guys?
I'll find him for $2,000, but I'll catch him and kill him. For 10. I love Robert Shaw.
I love that movie.
Like a doll's eyes, like dark.
Hello do to you, fair Spanish lead. I'm going to sing the whole song.
Back home, I got a taxidermy guy. He's going to have a heart attack when he sees what I bring him.
Yeah, that.
Hooper! Hey, Chief, I see you brought your rubbers.
That's what gets lost. That if people haven't seen it, you know, people think that's just shark chomping people left and right are real bloody. But it's actually a great cast, and like I said, great quotes. Robert Shaw's tremendous. He breaks Matt Hooper, Dreyfus's balls throughout the whole.
Oh my God!
Throughout the whole movie, yeah, you got City Hands Hooper, just good for counting money. He breaks his balls, but. Just great, and like you said, one of the first blockbusters, like word of mouth, just spread and like wildfire, and after a couple of weeks, you would just pass by movie theaters, and there would be lines just around the block, just to get it. It wasn't like today where like most everybody sees it like the first week, and people get in lines. This like built momentum, and still after like 5-6 weeks, it was out. There were lines everywhere. That people had to see it, the iconic preview where just when you thought it was safe to go into the water, and the music, everything all together, just really made it special.
Yeah.
And like I said, people were scared to go to to the beach and to go swimming. And people were legitimately scared, and it hurt businesses and at beaches and stuff.
Mm-hmm. See that little Kettner boy come out.
You're gonna like Kettner boy spilled out all over the dock. I love Murray Hamilton. He was awesome. A New Englander like me, I was scared shitless. And I do remember one time when I was a kid, my mom's friend and her kid, a couple of her kids. This is when before I was in school, maybe it was a summer. We went to Mesquamica Beach, Rhode Island. And, we actually had to go home because there was sharks and I lost my crap. this was the summer, I think, when Jaws 2 had come out, because Jaws 1, I was only 2 years old. But, Jaws changed everything about even New England and going to the beach and that kind of thing.
What year did Jaws 2 come out?
I think 78.
79?
79, yeah.
We'll get to it. As a sequel, it wasn't bad. I mean, you can't touch a classic, but it wasn't bad as a sequel.
No, I had no problem with
it. 78.
78. Uh-huh. And then the 3D one came out like in 82.
Forget about that.
Yeah. Oh, that was terrible.
We won't get into Jaws of Revenge. That's just a waste of Wi-Fi.
I saw one of the Jaws. It must have been the second one. I remember seeing in the movie theater when I was a kid. I don't think I saw it. 75. It was only two. I wouldn't remember.
Yeah, no, I don't think.
Yeah, Dreyfus wasn't in it.
Yeah, I think it was Jaws the 3D. I remember seeing that theater with the red and blue glasses.
Yes, I did too. My brother and I saw it in New Hampshire on vacation. I do remember that.
And I just only thing I like about Jaws: Revenge is Michael Caine is in that movie, and there's a shark and a bloody shark in the water. Is that what I think it is?
That movie.
She was only 8 years old, and she was eaten by a bloody shark.
Because sharks know where you live and follow you into other waters where they can't actually survive. They can't survive in tropical waters. Fucking idiots. Anyway, I don't know if any of you guys read the book. I don't know if any of you guys read Peter Benchley's book. I read the book Jaws, and there's actually Peter Benchley was not totally thrilled. He was happy with Spielberg and how he did the movie, but there's actually a huge subplot that. That was not put in the movie, and there's actually in the book there's kind of a veiled affair between Hooper and Brody's wife.
Really?
That was actually in the book that they did not explore in the movie. Would it have made a difference? Part of me says yes, because I feel like the camaraderie and the tightness between the three of them, Quint, Brody and Hooper on the boat, would have been probably sullied a little bit, because I'm pretty sure, if I remember correctly, I think he did find out in the book, but I don't think they actually did it either. I think they alluded to it. They met in a hotel. It was very strange, but it was in Peter Benchley's book that Hooper and Brody's wife were doing the deed. Having said that, typical big box office movie that, went over budget, cost a ton of money, the shark was a piece of junk, and and actually I'm looking at – here in Studio B, I'm looking up at one of my shelves, and I'm looking at the 1975 vintage Quint can that was made by Narragansett Beer. And that's actually why I love Narragansett, because it reminds me of my childhood when I first saw Jaws and I saw Robert Shaw guzzle the Gansett can and crush it. And that's why I love – that's kind of one of the reasons why I have a soft spot for Narragansett beer.
And then Hooper crushed the styrofoam coffee.
Yeah, and one of the greatest lines, too. You know, Roy Scheider's, Chief Brody sitting there putting the chum in the water. Hey, come back here and suffer some of this shit. All of a sudden, the shark comes out of the water and he just walks back with the cigarette hanging out of his mouth. You're going to need a bigger boat.
That's like one of the most epic quotes in movie history.
Mm-hmm. The scene with the Indianapolis story. They've been trying to make a movie about the Indianapolis for years, actually.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. But yeah, Jaws is one of the most iconic films ever. It put Spielberg on the map. So now each of them, the two bros there, Lucas and Spielberg, each had big hits. Lucas 2 years earlier had American Graffiti, and now Spielberg had Jaws. And then in 1977, when we get there, both of them had epic movies, and both of them had scores that were done by John Williams, who, in my opinion, is the greatest movie composer that ever lived. And so good irony there, mm-hmm. when we get to 77, but
it was like,
yeah,
it was like,
just
go ahead.
Amazing. No, I was just saying Jaws is amazing.
Yeah. And also the fact that the shark didn't work. And I just imagine if that thing did work, what kind of movie would be? Cause he had to create the suspense. He had to give you the fear of the unknown. Like,
right.
You know, that's terrifying, not knowing what the hell is coming up under the water. I mean,
that scene that you're talking about where Brody's throat chucking the chum in the ocean, that's the first time you actually see the shark.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what, like an hour and 45 minutes in?
Yeah, I don't know if it's that far, but it's pretty far in.
Or like maybe an hour and 20 minutes in, probably maybe an hour and a half.
I mean, I don't know if you may see the fin. I mean, I know we don't see it when the girl Chrissy is killed in the beginning.
No, you know, that's in the dark.
We don't see it with those two idiots with the roast.
Oh yeah, the roast. Yeah. Is the doc?
Yeah.
We don't see him when the Kinder kid gets chewed up in the blender.
Yeah.
That was actually one of the more. If you guys remember that scene, when the Kinder kid in the background is literally getting chummed up in the fucking, it literally was like the kid got thrown in a blender.
I know.
There's just fucking blood and body parts being chucked up in the air, and it's in the background while these other asshole kids in the front are chucking a football and fucking around. And meanwhile, like literally 10 feet away, this kid's getting chewed up in the blender with, you know, like a margarita. And that's like legitimately one of the most harrowing scenes ever. If you go back and watch, the next time you guys watch it, just watch that scene when the Kinder kid's getting like fucking chewed up. If you're like, and this is 1975,
mm-hmm.
horror movies. And I would say, to answer your question, Andy, this is probably a horror movie. Probably. Maybe you'd call it a thriller. I wouldn't call it action adventure. I would probably call it either a thriller or borderline horror movie.
Well, I've already called dibs on this for a freak out drive-in with Jenny, so.
Oh, God, I can imagine her. Oh, look at that kid getting fuck shit junked in the ocean.
My boy is dead.
My boy is dead.
You know, when Quint says she got dead eyes, like a doll's eyes, it reminds me of Scott's prom date.
For sure she did have dead eyes. weakened at Bernie that one.
And she probably slapped him like Mrs. Kintern did to Murray Hamilton.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Chief Brody actually got slapped, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I mean... That movie is legitimately terrifying. I mean, and to think, yeah, there were scary movies, there were horror movies that came out back in the day, and it'll be a few years before we talk about, like, Halloween, but, you know, there was, like, Black Christmas and some of the Dario Argento Italian horror films, but, and we had some good, like, thriller movies, like Dirty Harry with the, you know, with Andrew Robinson as the killer, and some movies like that, French Connection, but... This is one of the first movies where the villain legitimately can exist and can legitimately kill you.
Yeah.
I mean, you're swimming in whether it's, you know, Johnny out on the Long Island or G at, you know, fucking Coney Island or, you know, me and, you know, in Rhode Island or Connecticut or whatever. And you can legitimately get killed by a shark. I mean, it's highly unlikely if you know what the hell you are. But But it's at that time, 1975. What the fuck did you know? What did any of us know, really? You know, but it was just such a, you know, we didn't have summer movies back in those days. Movies just came out when they came out, and that was that. You know what I mean? I would say probably the closest thing to a disaster movie or a movie that would scare you because it could happen would be like The Towering Inferno, which is an absolutely tremendous film. Poseidon Adventure, Earthquake, Airport, like all those kind of movies. But Jaws was just – not only was it realistic, but it was legitimately terrifying.
Yeah.
And again, when you guys – next time you guys watch it, just – watch that scene where fucking Kintner's getting all chewed up in the background while those kids are chucking the football. It freaks you the fuck out. Like I remember watching when I was a kid and I like had to leave the room. It's like, you know, now I watched it on like Channel 8 or whatever, ABC, you know, Sunday night movie. So that scene got cut, you know, edited on network television. So when I first watched on HBO and that scene was not cut, and that was when I was maybe nine, even at 9 or 10 years old, I was still like freaking out, you know? So, but
Go ahead.
I was going to say, it's just never been the same.
He's not going to go down with three. Not with three. Time me off. Smile, you son of a bitch.
Yes. Tremendous, tremendous ending. And Roy Scheider was awesome.
Like
John said, what a cast. Mm-hmm. Even Murray Hamilton, who, I don't know what he was in before that, but he was great as the mayor. Lorraine Gary. She was kind of a hachi-machi for like a, you know, a cougar in the first movie. Yeah, there were hotter chicks in the second movie.
Yeah.
The oldest son grows up and they're all, you know, teenage.
They're all they're boating. Yeah. You know, Robert Shaw was not the first choice though.
It was
Lee Marvin.
Sterling
Hayden and Lee Marvin were the first choices. Sterling Hayden, apparently had owed a lot of money to the government. I think we talked about this when we talked about The Godfather.
Yes.
But yeah. And then Lee Marvin.
How's the Italian food in this boat?
Lee Marvin was out doing like real, like, you know, deep water fishing. He's like, why would I want to come back to do the fake shit? You know, he was done with Hollywood, you know. But yeah, Spielberg did a tremendous, and they were rewriting that movie also constantly because of what was going on with it. It was over budget. I mean, this would have doomed him. If this bombed, you know, if he didn't get this movie off the ground, we would not know of Steven Spielberg today. All right. So any last thoughts on Jaws? Hello?
I think we said it all.
I was going to say, did I lose you guys? Yeah, I think we said enough. Scott, you still there? Are you on mute?
That's weird. My microphone muted on its own. That was weird. Anyway.
Finally, it was like that in real life.
The microphone got tired of your voice.
That was weird. I was talking. Yeah.
Guy thinks he's a pop culture guru and he hasn't seen One Flew Over the Fucking Cuckoo's Nest. What's next? Star Wars either? Anyway. But no, what's funny about that is you can't buy the four Jaws movies in like a pack. Like there's no box set like on DVD or Blu-ray. You have to buy them individually. But you can find it on like I don't are they on Netflix? I think they're on Netflix actually.
Yeah, the first
I think all four Jaws are on Netflix.
Is.
Yeah, I think all four Jaws are on Netflix. Check it out.
Yeah, where you get to, you know, it just gets progressively worse as it goes.
Absolutely. No, that's true. Like any series of movies, I guess, or franchise of movies.
All right. So, you know, I think that's going to wrap up 1975. That's a fun year. We have a big year coming up. We have the bicentennial year in our next episode, which as of right now, look for that early July, right? So, you know, John, what's going on over there in this week in sports? You and the Cowboy still moving along here?
Yes, sir. Bi-weekly. Try to time it with after every round of the NBA playoffs. That's pretty much hot and heavy now. And then we'll get into baseball and other shenanigans. Keeping up with the sports bi-weekly. Along with the mothership, 1989 WrestleMania. You'll hear me on the SummerSlam 89 soon, as the boys trek along.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. G, we'll see you back on the 1976 episode. His microphone's muting
Maybe
him
not.
Now. Maybe not. That's it. Scott, what's going on over there?
Oh, you know what? It looks like he muted too.
Yeah.
What happened? Everybody's mics, I think, muted at the same time. That was weird.
No.
Anyway, he's on this show.
Yeah.
He will be on a future. He will be on a future main event too. He's a main event alum.
Mm-hmm.
My next show will be next Monday. Let me confirm that with my swanky little schedule here. Yeah, our next JR's and my next Place to Be podcast will be, I believe it is next week, but let me confirm that. I don't
wanna... probably be out actually before this.
before this comes out, yes.
Yeah, so this is dropping on Tuesday after Memorial Day, I believe, per the manager, Todd
okay,
Weber.
Well, if that is the case, we're actually going to do back-to-back shows that week. Well, at least we're recording them. We're going to have the 5-8. We're actually going to walk out of the garden, Johnny. I'm going to tell you this. We're going to do the April 8th, 1989 Meadowlands house show.
All right. So the PT Band Studios is under reconstruction.
Our studios. Exactly. The gardens, our offices were being kicked out. So we're going down to Jersey, Dr. G. I think it was still the Brendan Byrne.
The Brendan Byrne.
Thank God.
Yep.
And then we got a couple of Serenades.
Now you can hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you now.
We're going to say Dr. G is going to be on.
I have no idea how my mic got muted. I didn't even touch it.
Mine was too. It was very strange. I was going to say, well, you missed us. What I said was you're going to be on our next podcast. Instead of the dark side of the ring, the dark side of radio when you killed John Denver. So check us out, Place to Be Podcast. Of course, later this week, since you said this is coming out the following Tuesday, will be the next episode of the main event. We're going to have Brandon Howard on it to talk a little WWE finances, and then we'll have our next TNA Classic pay-per-view recap. So, and then looking ahead, join you guys again for 1976, the Bicentennial, guys, the Bicentennial. Did a certain movie come out in 76? Oh, are we going to be talking about? I believe we are. Oh, yeah, Dr. G, you're going to get ready? You're going to wear the top hat, the Count of Monte Fisto? Oh, yeah. Oh, well, I'm pumped for 76 movies, Mr. Atherton. It's going to be huge. Did you see any of these movies? You better watch them all.
Very funny.
What the hell you're talking about? Looking forward to it. Plenty to do on the pop.
Ticket to the zoo.
Ticket to the zoo. I heard. Oh, God, I can't say it. I mean, dude, we'd get thrown off the feed. Anyway, Mr. Atherton.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and Scott, you're actually going to be making a debut on one of my shows, the one show you have not been on yet.
I know, but you had the most episodes.
Yes. I think it's going to be Laughing Theater, I think, is ahead of it, because that's a very easy show to do. It's much easier to schedule one person than three or six, I found out.
That is the Scott Criscolo Podcast Network.
Well, he's usually on my first episode of each of my shows. He's being nicknamed the Cherry Poppin' Daddy. A Place to Be Nation.
Yep.
Somebody please change that in a chat to him. That to his name. But yeah, great.
Anyway, I'm going to be on the next episode of The Great Debate.
Yes, that's right.
The non-wrestling Great Debate.
Mm-hmm.
Finally.
Yes. Look for that towards the mid to end of June. Like I said earlier, my latest episode of Laughing Theater just dropped. Miss Jennifer Smith joined me for Dumb and Dumber. And then coming up, the other half of Geek and Sassy. We'll be on the next episode, and we're going to be talking about an installment of another movie that's coming out this year. So it'll be very timely. And then your PIC will be joining me on Laughing Theater after that. So, yeah, we got to...
So I'm amazed.
Yeah?
he barely goes to the movies.
Well, this is not a current movie, though. You know?
That's true, too.
So look for all that stuff. Like we said earlier, you know, check out PlaceToBeNation.com, all kinds of great content. Starting to build up the Greatest Song of the 80s tournament reboot should be starting very soon, within the next few weeks, once we get all the ducks in a row. So look for that on the Facebook page. Please like it if you haven't. Also, like The Great Debate. with daily polls going up. We're going to start our nightly PM polls again soon once, you know, things settle down here over in Studio C. But so yeah, guys, you know, great episode. This is our fourth episode, right? So we're plugging along through the 70s. So for Scott Criscolo, J.R. Cineo D'Amato, and George Rubellino, I'm Andy Atherton. Thank you for joining us here as we looked at 1975, and we'll see you in 1976. Take care, everybody.
And Dr.
Show
G.
Show me the way to go home.
I'm tired and I want to go to bed.
I had a little drink thinking about it.
80s Joel!
That Kettner kid.
Okay. Oh God.